Hi, I'm Elisa Lamel, Legal Content Specialist for Cross Financial. Today, I'm excited to introduce Valerie Geiger, an esteemed elder law attorney and managing partner at Cusinelli Geiger PC. With over two decades of experience in the field of elder law, Valerie's unique perspective, derived from her roles as a trustee, medical agent, guardian, and conservator, provide her with invaluable insights into the impact these plans have on clients and their families. In our discussion, Valerie shared her expertise on crucial topics, such as determining the suitability of establishing a guardianship for your clients, effective Medicaid spend-down strategies you can use, and practical guidance for preparing a Medicaid spend-down plan within the framework of a guardianship. Hi, Valerie. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Absolutely. So today we're going to be talking about all things guardianships. Your office handles a lot of different types, from contested to amicable to conservatorships, all sorts of it. So the first question that I'm wondering is, what are you looking for in determining whether someone might be a good fit for a guardianship? What do those case facts look like?
Sure. When we're meeting with a family, usually it's the children, a spouse, it could be neighbors. The first thing we're hoping to see that they bring to the table is some sort of medical evidence. Maybe they have a report from a neurologist, primary care physician, or some sort of medical documentation that states they have incapacity. If they do not have that kind of documentation, then we're listening to kind of anecdotal information from the family and determining whether we're arranging for them to get that evaluation needed to move forward with the guardianship. So we're starting there, hoping there's medical evidence in the file. And then we're looking to see if we do have that information, like they're incapacitated, what documents do they have in place that maybe would, you know, negate the need for the guardianship? So do they have an advanced medical director? Do they have a durable power of attorney? What's in place that maybe we don't have to take that step?
Okay, so are there ever situations where somebody does have a power of attorney that's in place, but they might still need a guardianship?
Yeah, that's where our contested guardianship background usually comes. a lot of the contests are someone already having documents in place. For example, maybe like mom has her power of attorney or a medical directive and power of attorney. She has named one of the children, and maybe there's three others, and the one that has that authority is not sharing information, not allowing access to mom. There's suspicion by the other children of maybe exploitation. So that's a great example. Or sticking with mom, maybe they do have the financial power of attorney, but mom keeps going down to the bank, and because the bank feels like she can still make a decision, is accessing accounts, pulling out money, and causing chaos financially. So that could be another example of, you know, the docket, they did everything right with the planning. It's just behaviors through the family are making it a little difficult.
So a lot of times when I hear people talk about guardianships, I hear this concept of a guardian ad litem. So what's a guardian ad litem, and what role do they play in this overall process?
Sure. A guardian ad litem is usually an attorney, court appointed, to act as the eyes and ears of the court. They are basically an extension of the court. They are charged with going out and investigating the allegations in the petition, which are twofold. One, is the respondent or individual incapacitated as defined by the code? And if so, then who should be appointed to act on their behalf? They're doing all that. And then if there's other allegations, like we kind of just mentioned about exploitation or other sorts of abuse, they're going to be talking to other family members, gathering financial information, talking to the primary care or other physician. And that kind of culminates in a report that they then submit to the court to help the judge make their decision as to the ultimate findings of the case.
Okay, so they're really trying to act on behalf of that individual who's going to be under a guardianship.
Yes, they're trying to figure out what is in what we call the respondent's best interest.
Okay, So let's talk about how that plays into Medicaid planning a little bit. So I would imagine that there are some Medicaid spend down strategies that might go under extra scrutiny if someone's under a guardianship. So what are the type of Medicaid spend down strategies that you can use while you're under a guardianship?
I'm sure you could probably try to file a petition for anything, but the ones that I've done, I felt comfortable doing, transferring the house from one spouse to another spouse, using a special needs trust, maybe if the person's under 65 and that's appropriate. The caregiver child exemption, where, you know, the child's been living in the home and but for their care for the last 2 years, mom or dad would have had to go to a nursing home sooner. And then, you know, a Medicaid compliant annuity strategy could also be spelled out in a petition as to why that would be an appropriate next step in long-term care planning.
Okay, so you made a point that raised a question. So you used the caregiver, transferring the home to the caregiver. Are there ever situations in that strategy where maybe the will conflicts with what you're going to be doing under a Medicaid plan? And how do you remedy that?
Sure. So when you're filing a petition and employing any sort of Medicaid strategy, I think of it under the terms of like gifting. So we have specific code sections addressing it. It requires specific notice of any beneficiary that could be impacted by the court's ruling. And so you need to demonstrate to the court that you have provided that notice. And you definitely want to read the will, and hopefully what you're requesting or possibly what you're requesting is in line with their estate plan. If it's not, we need to explain why we need to do something different. And if we do, then those beneficiaries named in the will definitely need the notice, definitely need to, if you can, get them to participate and sign off on the relief requested.
Okay, so you mentioned also that a lot of the steps throughout a guardianship involves court approval. So can you talk to me a little bit about how difficult or maybe easy it is to obtain court approval for some of these Medicaid spend down strategies?
I think asking any sort of gifting Medicaid strategy in the context of a guardianship does raise the difficulty of getting the court to approve. So not necessarily the appointment of a guardian, but or a conservator, but having that conservator be able to have extra powers, superpowers, to do that necessary long-term care planning. It's really important to lay out in your petition why you're doing it. And to me, it's a numbers reason as to why this is in the individual's best interest. And I think sometimes people tend to lean towards maybe the caregiver child's best interest or whatever as how they're drafting. But this has to really solely be about why is it in the incapacitated person's best interest for this plan. So I think that's where people maybe misstep a little bit.
Would you say it's more complicated to maybe get a plan approved when you're using gifting as part of a spend down strategy versus using it with a married couple?
I think that's absolutely true. I think it's more compelling to a court when you have a spouse that is not ill. You know, they have, you know, finances that maybe aren't sufficient for both of them to have these kinds of long-term care events. And you can show by numbers, if we stay on this path, they're out of money in so many months. And it's kind of more, and then you're leaving the other spouse completely, you know, impoverished. So I think it's more compelling than doing just a straight gifting strategy, maybe to kids or to others.
Okay, so I would imagine you're writing out a very meticulous plan and explaining where every dollar's going when you're submitting this for approval. So do you also ever run into the hurdle of having to sort of explain this to the guardian ad litem and the judge and kind of explain and teach them what you're trying to do exactly?
Every time. in the county that we primarily practice, the court has a list, so we're not able to pick our guardian ad litems. We're just given them. And I think a practice has developed, which the court likes will entertain some of the time of us motioning then for a guardian ad litem experience in Medicaid planning, because otherwise you're spending a lot of time educating the guardian ad litem as to, the Medicaid manual, what the Medicaid rules are, maybe federal rules, and then just how this is in the individual's best interest. So it will help if you can get somebody who's experienced in Medicaid planning as your guardian ad litem. In other counties around us, we can pick the guardian ad litem, and it's much easier to then identify those that, you know, have that background, so you can skip that step. But having your guardian ad litem be educated and being able to be conversant with you on the day of your hearing is super helpful, because then they can help explain to the judge why this is necessary and appropriate for the incapacitated person.
Okay. And so you touched on a couple things, and I just want to circle back on those. You mentioned things like showing the guardian ad litem the Medicaid regulations that offer this authority, and also, you know, explaining how this is in the respondent's best interest. What other things might you show to them that kind of help explain and educate them on this spend down strategy?
Again, I would rely on numbers. Numbers don't lie. If they stay on this course, this is where they're going to be. Also having the other family members, if they're going to be impacted by this, sign on and bless the transaction. I think that gives everybody a level of comfort that there's not going to be people coming back and contesting. Maybe some other, you know, charts and graphs that we can put together to put that education in front of them.
Okay, perfect. So fast forward to the end when you finally have everything in order, you know that you're going to be applying for a guardianship and getting that started. What is the timeline look for completing the guardianship versus completing the Medicaid application and getting everything submitted all in the right timing?
I think that's sometimes difficult, and I don't know that it always works out in a pretty package. I think if you can pick your guardian ad litem and call them in advance and say, here's what I'm filing, here's the timeline, can you do this job in that amount of time? The county we practice in has hearings every Friday. Some courts, it's a little more scattered. But if you can kind of talk to the guardian ad litem in advance and say, we're looking at this hearing date so we can get those approvals to line up your application timing with the authority, then I think it goes much smoother. So it just depends on the guardian ad litem and when you can get that hearing date.
Okay, and I guess I would imagine based on that there's some stuff that maybe goes out of your control as far as working with the court calendar and the GAL's calendar that doesn't always fit well together.
That's right. The best laid plans, I think they say.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for your time today, Valerie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed our conversation.